Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Absolutely delighted to be in conversation today with Ann Erickson. Ann is vice chair of WMC's board of directors, president and CEO of Empire Justice Center, and recently announced her retirement, having been with Empire Justice since 1989. She started as a policy analyst and legislative coordinator and became president when the organization's director of over 30 years retired in 2000. Prior to taking on her current leadership of the organization, Ann directed the legislative and policy advocacy work of the Greater Upstate Law Project, working closely with GOLPS staff and attorneys. She then helped develop and pursue an annual legislative agenda focused primarily on health and welfare issues, and provided statewide leadership in efforts to strengthen and improve access to justice and to expand funding for civil legal services. She's a former chair of the Equal Justice Commission, helped lead the LSC-driven state planning effort in New York State, and was an adjunct instructor for the Center for Women in Government graduate fellowship program for many years, offering an intense course on the practical workings of state government, the development of the state budget, and the interactions between and among the various branches of state government. Before entering the world of advocacy, Ann was a journalist working as the first legislative correspondent for WAMC Northeast Public Radio, providing daily coverage of state government and politics and developing and hosting a weekly half-hour news show, The Legislative Gazette. Ann is a graduate of SUNY New Paltz with a dual major in English journalism and political science. We'll talk with Ann Erickson about all of that, but first, welcome my old friend. We've been together for a long time, Ann Erickson.
Thank you, Alan. It's just absolutely a delight to be here.
What folks don't know, and what I will be eternally grateful for, is the fact that if there was no Ann Erickson, no doubt there would have been no Legislative Gazette. Perhaps you could start with that story. How did that all work?
Oh, well, and as you know, the Gazette just celebrated its 40th anniversary. So that was my very first session coming up as an intern. First year we published the Legislative Gazette, and some in the legislature got absolutely ballistic that we, as a bunch of students, particularly from SUNY New Paltz, coming in and covering their committee meetings, pounding the pavement, walking the halls, interviewing them in their offices, giving rank-and-file members an opportunity to be seen and heard. And within, what was it, a week or two, we were told, cease and desist. You cannot be here. You have to get out. And I remember you coming in that Monday morning in one of our political science seminars and saying, you know, I'm really sorry, but this isn't going to work. We've been told we have to leave. And I just went, absolutely not. This is like the only thing that has made sense to me. I had already gone to school for a year. I had stopped school. I had worked for a year. I had come back to school. And I was like, this is now making sense. And so I did what we had been taught to do as reporters and started asking questions and went over to the LCA, which is the Legislative Correspondents Association. They had been wonderful. They had allowed us as student interns to become members of the LCA, which is the Reporters Association at the Capitol. And I remember talking to E.J. Dionne, who at that point was with the New York Times, and saying, we got to go. They told us we have to go. And he and a couple of the other reporters started making a few phone calls, asking a few questions. And lo and behold, we were told we could stay. Yeah.
Well, as I remember a little bit differently. When I told you that you were going to have to go because the legislature wouldn't permit it, you used a very untypical expletive. and said, that ain't going to happen. And then it was an amazing development because you decided that since there was no money, none,
yes,
nobody got paid, you all had to bring your own typewriter with you. Remember that?
Oh, I do. Oh, my God, typewriters.
You had to bring paper. You had to bring pencils. You had to bring pads. None of those things
existed. No phones, no cells. No, we were sitting on the stairwell with our typewriters.
Yeah, it's amazing. So what you did is you decided, since you were working at night, where were you working?
I was working at the Lock Tavern.
At the Lock Tavern, which is very close to the legislature. And what were you doing there?
I was mostly working in the kitchen.
Yeah. And so you decided you were going to put on a fundraiser for the Legislative Gazette to come up with a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And you announced it. And tell us about that. It is a evening, which is in indelibly on my mind. Brings tears to my eyes.
That was amazing.
Tell me about it.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you don't know what you don't know, like, right? So, as you said, if you were an intern in the legislature, you were in a Senate or Assembly office, you got a stipend. Yeah. And we did not because the Gazette was so new, you barely had enough money to print the thing every week. And we were putting out a weekly newspaper and the printing costs. And then we were trying to get a lot of photography in and we had no darkroom equipment. And so we decided to hold a fundraiser because, again, I'm walking the halls of the Capitol and that's what people did. They held wine and cheese parties and, you know, raised money. I was working at the Lock Tavern to, you know, pay rent and asked them if they could help. They said, you know, Monday nights are slow around here for us. And I said, Monday nights are perfect. And I remember coming to you and Glenn Doty and saying, this is what we're going to do. And somehow it just all came together. You know, we had, you know, our friends, the other students did music and we had the back room. And
I played the banjo. Yep, I remember that.
That's right. That's right. And we had, you know, just cheese and crackers and beer and wine or whatever it was.
But
and
something amazing happened.
It was incredible. Now, you tell that part of the story.
No, I want you to. So. Well, I mean, it's your interview. So very early in the evening, the first legislator to come in was Olga Mendez.
Yep.
And it was amazing. She sat down. She talked to the students. Brilliant. You know, I mean, I don't know what her motivation was, but we all appreciated it, right?
It was great. Yeah.
And the second person to come in the room was the president of the Senate, otherwise known as the lieutenant governor of New York State, whose name happened to be Mario Matthew Cuomo.
Yeah.
And he sat on a bench and he talked to everybody. Now, what was incredible about that, Annie, as you remember, it was also the night of the pompous Senate dinner, which they all got together. And the old guys, now remember, Warren Anderson was a Republican, the majority leader of the Senate, and they weren't going to come, although they had all been invited, right?
Everybody had been invited.
And by the way, just so everybody knows, don't feel too bad for the Lark Tavern, because as I remember it, it was not an open bar. You paid for your drinks.
Well, we had beer donated and we had some wine donated. But other than that, yeah, you paid.
Good for you. Good for you, Ann. And so the lieutenant governor sits down, and he stays there, and he stays there. He does not walk out. Yeah. It's not a walk through. Mario Cuomo, the lieutenant governor of New York State, is sitting there talking to us, and we are astounded, right?
Yep. And then right about, I don't know, 11 midnight, the doors open and in comes Warren Anderson and Ornstein and Duryea and was it Fink at the time was speaker?
Yeah, it was Fink.
And they all came in. And because we had just blanketed the place, we were like, you got to come. You got to help us out. We won't be able to stay. We actually had a resolution passed on the floor of the assembly that afternoon commemorating the Legislative Gazette for its internship. Yes, I still have that.
I don't remember that.
Yeah,
That's great.
Yeah. It was so relaxed and so much fun, and we raised enough money to get some darkroom equipment, but it was, I think that was the moment that the Legislative Gazette turned a corner. And that was year two, because year one, we were just holding on by the skin of our teeth. And then I came back year two as a student editor, myself and Donna Ciaccio. And that was the year we had the fundraiser. So it's 40 years ago this year.
It's an amazing story. Yeah. When I thought it up, you know, one of the great compliments to me in my life was I had thought up the Legislative Gazette. And I went to the powers at New Paltz, and they sort of told me it would fail. And they told me all the reasons we couldn't do it. And they were probably right.
Well, it was like you telling me why I couldn't have the fundraiser. Yeah, and I was like, oh, we can do this.
Yeah, we can do this. And you did it. Now, when I asked Cuomo years later, because we got to be pretty friendly. How come you did it? And he said, quote, I did it for the girl. I did it for the girl. How come?
Well, I remember interviewing him. So one of the things we had to do with the Gazette was to obviously do, you know, one-on-one interviews. We were each assigned a beat of different, you know, substantive law areas. But for some reason, I had to interview, you know, I got the assignment to interview Cuomo. And he was awesome. He spent so much time with me just explaining things. Because we came up, I mean, I'll admit, I had no idea what I was doing, right? You know, so it wasn't like we knew the process or we knew any of the players or we knew the dynamic. You know, I remember when I came back as a student editor, one of the first things I did was a glossary of terms and a flow chart of how a bill becomes a law, really. And Cuomo was just, you know, he must have spent over an hour just going through how the legislature worked. He talked about pro bono work, and I had no idea what that was or how important that would become to my career. And he explained what, you know, I was 21 years old or whatever. I had no idea. And he was great. And I remember when we did the fundraiser, I went and said, you know, it was Woody Fichette was his press secretary. And I said, you know, he's got to come. It would mean so much to the students if he showed up. And
really?
So he did. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I never knew that part of it. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
That's really great. So he came. And from that moment on, the Legislative Gazette was alive and breathing. And it really is due to you. I mean, I may have thought it up, but believe me, it all had to fall into place. And that moment, that one prescient moment, was so important. And of course, none of us have ever forgotten that that moment.
Well, and it really launched my life in many ways, you know. So it really gave me some grounding and networking opportunities and ability to see and be seen and hear and be heard. And, you know, when I, well, as you may remember, I also then took off for a while. I worked with you here at WAMC doing the legislative correspondence and continuing with some of the journalism, and then, you know, kind of went off and did my California thing, you know, to find myself. And when I came back, you know, deciding to really go into policy and advocacy rather than back into journalism. And actually, Governor Cuomo then became important in that realm as well, because I worked on children's issues. We did the first Children's Collaborative. We worked on Child Health Plus, and with then Commissioner of Health David Axelrod on the first prenatal care assistance program.
I want to interrupt for a moment.
And then the Decade of the Child with Mario Cuomo.
I want to come back to that. I just want to remind everybody who's just tuning in that we're talking to Ann Erickson. Played a big part in all of our lives, and Ann Erickson is an amazing, amazing woman. Okay, so you were going to say the Year of the Child. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, so the Decade of the Child. So when I started working more from a policy and advocacy perspective, I took all of what I had learned at the Gazette, obviously, you know, where to find things, how to find things. And again, the networking of different members of the legislature, Dick Godfrey, Jim Talon, you know, some of the folks that were doing cutting edge work around health and access to benefits. And really, the notion of government being able to help those in need and really being a force for good and a force for equality and justice, which sounds so corny, but it is so true. And with Governor Cuomo, Mario Cuomo, we had worked a lot on children's issues and trying to pull together all the different pieces. So child health and income supports and special education and daycare and all the things that low and moderate income families need in order to survive, in the first prenatal care assistance program. So we had women that if you were poor enough to be on Medicaid, you got your prenatal care. But if you were uninsured and in that lower income bracket, you were kind of out of luck. And we thought, what a waste, you know, to not make sure that we provide prenatal care. And so those were some of the components of that first Decade of the Child that Cuomo laid out.
And Ann Erickson, who were you working for then when you were doing all that?
So I was working with an organization called Statewide Youth Advocacy. It was run by Eve Brooks. It was based in Rochester, which would also become important in my life. You remember Eve?
I do. I remember who she was married to.
Yes, Eve and Stephen Brooks. And Stephen became part of my later life as well as counsel to the IOLA Fund, which funds civil legal services, which is where I landed for the bulk of my life has been in civil legal services. And even that, you know, I got recruited to come into legal services, which was then the organization at that point was called the Greater Upstate Law Project. And I didn't know what legal services was. You know, I had been working on kids' issues. I'd been working on access to health, working on the Child Health Plus program, prenatal program, some child care, daycare.
And who was
issues.
That for?
That was for SYA. That was for the Children's
SYA.
Collaborative.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I got recruited by Joanne Smith to come into the Greater Upstate Law Project. And I did not know what legal services was. And the more I learned, the more I realized how critical it is to have a network of civil legal services providers, because we can do everything in terms of expanding eligibility, expanding your right to programs and services, expanding anti-discrimination laws. But if you don't have lawyers on the ground making sure that those laws, those rights, those protections, those services are honored and enforced, we have not done our job. And as someone who came out of sort of the human services realm of things in child advocacy, that to me was like we'd been missing the boat. And so I've worked all these years to just make sure that that becomes part and parcel of what we do, that people need to have access to civil legal services or we have not done the full job. And you're seeing that now, how important the lawyers are. You know, I know you get a lot of jokes about lawyers and all of that, but look at what's going on around this country, whether it's the big picture challenging the underlying law itself, or it's the individual representing the one-on-one, the immigrant that's being denied access to asylum or refugee status, families being, you know, at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes and not having due process or an opportunity to be heard in court, families losing their health care, life-saving health care, and not having an opportunity to challenge those denials.
Now, this is not criminal. This is not criminal representation. This is the civil side.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, on the criminal side, thankfully, we all know the routine. You have a right to counsel. If you can't afford one, one will be appointed for you. On the civil side, not so much. Mm-hmm. Not so much. And you're coming up against some huge systems. You're coming up against government. You're coming up against health industry. You're coming up against the immigration infrastructure. You're coming up against the banks and the servicers. You know, I've also been honored to be appointed by then Chief Judge Lipman and reappointed by Judge DeFiore to the Permanent Commission on Access to Justice. And when we started in 2009, we had 2.3 million people in New York State going into civil court every year without representation.
Wow.
2.3 million people going into court trying to represent themselves against the banks, against government. And the judiciary, the Office of Court Administration, has done a phenomenal job of investing in expanding access to legal services. And so now we are down to 1.8 million people going into civil court every year without representation.
So how does it work? I mean, obviously this covers all of New York State. Are there chapters or are there offices? How does it work?
So civil legal services, you know, goes back actually to some of the settlement houses in New York City and German immigrants coming over and providing support to each other. In the war on poverty in the 60s and the early 70s, the civil legal services became part of a federal infrastructure of providing attorneys and legal support to low-income communities. So there is a federal construct that is funded on a per poor person basis to each county in New York State. And it basically, or throughout the country actually, and it basically goes from the federal government right to the local programs. And in New York State, we have regional federally funded programs. Those programs really provide the bread and butter frontline assistance. Then we have a network in New York State. We are really blessed. We have a very rich delivery system. We have pro bono programs, which are private attorneys volunteering their time. Think about it. It's the only industry we have where the profession actually sits for itself and says, we have an obligation to make sure there is access to justice. You don't see the doctors saying, you know, we have an obligation to make sure people have access to health care. But the lawyers, the Bar Association, take that very seriously. They have aspirational goals that every attorney provides so many hours of free legal services to low-income people. So we have that network. And then, you know, the federally funded network is somewhat restricted in what it's able to do. So then we have kind of a unrestricted network of services. For me, at Empire Justice Center, we are not part of the federal system anymore. We had been. When Gingrich came in, we kind of got kicked out because he didn't want organizations that were doing some of the big picture stuff. So we can do class actions. We can do legislative advocacy. We can represent some of the individuals that the federally funded programs cannot do. They cannot do class actions. They can only do legislative advocacy in some restricted way. So, you know, the federally funded system is a little bit restricted in terms of what it can do. And so organizations like mine at Empire Justice, we're able to provide more of the big picture issues. So really getting in, and what we like to say is our job as Empire Justice is to really change the systems within which people live. So we do a lot of the impact work. We do the class action work. We challenge some of those underlying systems. We get into the legislature. We are registered lobbyists with the state of New York. We do a very aggressive legislative agenda, both proactively and defensively, to try to make sure that the needs of the low-income communities are heard and represented. And then we do a full range of direct legal assistance as well. So in New York, we have a pretty diverse and dynamic network of civil legal services for which we are great.
Annie, do you ever set those up yourself? I mean, some of the most obscure places you could ever think of, like the Finger Lakes region and other places like that, how do those organizations get formed in order to do this incredibly important work?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the infrastructure has been around since the War on Poverty issues and the EEO. So many of them, you know, have been around since the 70s. We did go through a period, you know, in the 90s on some reorganization. So now we have pretty big, substantial regional programs in each region of the state. So it's a pretty well-established network of services. So again, for Empire Justice, we have offices in Rochester, here in Albany, down in Westchester, and on Long Island, so that we can provide kind of that network of services, you know, in partnership with our colleagues.
And I guess I wanted to ask you this. You rose to be the chief of all of this. How did that happen?
Well, I had been the legislative coordinator. As I said, I kind of got recruited to come in to legal services when the founding director decided to retire. I had been with them for about 10 years, and I thought, you know, this is a moment for me organizationally and for me personally and professionally, like if not now, when? So I threw my hat in the ring, and the board, you know, it's a nonprofit organization, so the board hires the CEO.
And who's the board? Did they represent component parts from around the state? How does the board
No, work? It's a self-appointing board for a nonprofit. We're not a membership organization. Similar to WAMC, the board recruits its next round of board members. We do have term limits, so we're always recruiting new board members, but that is the job of the board.
So was it tough to get the job?
Well, you know, here was the challenge. So I am not an attorney, so that was a big leap. I'm one of the few non-attorneys, certainly in New York and probably around the country, that runs a legal services program. And our corporate headquarters are in Rochester. And even though I had lived in Rochester for a while, I really wanted to be in Albany because I think, obviously, this is the hub of certainly the policy work. And, you know, it was a pretty intense process. We went through a number of different interviews. They had done a national search and decided to give me a chance.
Did you have to convince them of your merits?
I did. You know, I really did. I had to.
You're terrific. How'd you do it?
You know, it was, well, you know, it was tough. And I think the vision I presented in terms of the role that at that point Greater Upstate Law Project, now Empire Justice, the role that we played was critical in terms of our statewide policy work and our statewide advocacy work and the statewide litigation that we take. A lot of what we do, as you can imagine, is make sure that there is the balance between New York City and the rest of the state. So again, for my organization, we are Long Island and the rest of the state. We work very closely with our colleagues in New York City, but a lot of what we're doing, whether it's legislatively, looking at state funding, impact litigation, class actions, we bring the rest of the state to the table in all of those conversations.
We're talking to Ann Erickson, one of the people I admire the most in the world, who is an extraordinary individual. So, Ann, let's go into the personal. You come from a big family, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So I am one of 15 kids, born and raised on Long Island. I am the sixth of those 15. And, you know, it was a wonderful, chaotic, amazing family to grow up in. We're still all very close. We love to gather, you know, so I like to travel. One of the things we're planning right now, actually, is myself and four of my sisters are going to Paris. So five of the seven girls.
There were seven girls and...
Seven girls, eight boys.
Wow.
Yeah, and...
How did that change you? I mean, the guys and the girls, did you have to speak for yourself?
Oh, absolutely. If you didn't figure out how to speak up, you just got lost in the shuffle. And I like to say, you know, I was born in the kind of chaotic middle, five older and nine younger. And I consider myself the oldest of the middle five, because we really were, in a way, five different families. My oldest brothers and sisters really grew up with, you know, heavy involvement from my grandparents and from great aunts and uncles. And by the time some of the middle kids came along, you know, the grandparents were not really around quite, you know, more. And for the younger kids, never even knew their grandparents. So they grew up with a lot of older brothers and sisters, whereas, you know, the older brothers and sisters grew up with a lot of younger brothers. It's just incredibly, wonderfully chaotic, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. And it shaped me in a way that I had to find my place. I had to be able to speak up. My mom was amazing. The older I got, the more I realized the incredible ability to organize and keep a household running and keep, you know, the laundry done and the food on the table. And we all had chores before we could walk, basically. And it was, you know, everybody chipped in. There was no, if it was your turn to take out the garbage, it didn't matter, boys or girls. If it was your turn to scrub the floor or clean the bathroom or, you know, it just, we all had chores, mow the lawn, shovel the walk, whatever.
Were the boys protective of the girls?
Yes. You
know, tell us about that.
You know, you get into middle school and high school, and it's, you know, don't mess with Anne because her older brother Steve will, you know, take care of you if you do. And, you know, so there was like a security there. Yeah.
Wow.
It's fun.
That's amazing.
It's a lot of fun. So, and I now have like 37 nieces and nephews and a bunch of great nieces. Well, I shouldn't say a bunch. I think there's four now. So I'm looking forward to getting to meet more of them. Yeah.
Do you ever feel a lack of, you know, attention because you're one of 15?
You know, I've been thinking about that lately. I don't know if it was a lack of attention, but it was sort of like you couldn't dwell on yourself. You know, like you couldn't, oh, you know, woe is me, or he doesn't like me, or she talked wrong to me, or I didn't, you know, it was sort of like, just keep going. You know, if you wanted to pout and sit in a corner, go for it, but nobody's really going to pay much attention to you. So you might as well just get back in the game.
Well, you've had an astounding career already, and I'm sure that there'll be other things that are going to come along now. So let's talk about that for a moment. You have hobbies. One of your hobbies that I know about is that you're a massage person. I always want to say misogynist, but you're not that.
No. So I am a licensed massage therapist.
How did that happen?
So that happened, I was going through some changes in my life a number of years ago. My dad had passed. My mom was very sick. I was going through some personal issues, and I found massage to just be so helpful in releasing some of that tension and anxiety and stress.
You mean getting a massage or
getting,
giving a massage?
Yeah, oh no, getting.
Okay.
I just find that it really should be part of our healthcare system. It's an incredible way of getting grounded and being able to let go of some of that stress that we really hold in our muscles and that can then cause more damage if not taken care of. So I had always been kind of fascinated by it. I found myself one evening at an open house at the Center for Natural Wellness School of Massage Therapy, which is an underwriter of WAMC, I am pleased to note. And it just all came together. I found myself enrolling, the schedule lined up. I went to school for almost 2 years. Three nights a week for 3 hours a night, I learned more than I thought my brain could ever retain. It was absolutely astonishing.
What'd you learn?
Oh, muscles and anatomy and physiology and right down to organic chemistry and how our cells work and how they, you know, regenerate themselves and get rid of the toxic waste and move things along and how your muscles, you know, connected to tendons, connected to bones, connected to everything. And, you know, from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, it all can move as one entity. And as if you get jammed up in any one place, what that can cascade out to. Likewise, if you get that taken care of, how that can cascade out as well. You know, we learned shiatsu, we learned anatomy, physiology, organic chemistry a little bit. We had mandatory community service, and I did my community service at St. Peter's Hospice, which was unbelievable.
Tell us about that. Because we just lost somebody in our family, and we know what hospice means.
Oh,
it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's beautiful. It's extraordinary. I was blessed that both my parents died at home. And we are so blessed to have two nurses in our family, and my one sister, Catherine, walked us through that. You know, just the knowledge of what to expect and how to manage it and how to take care of yourself through it as you're taking care of your parents. But hospice was, so we would go on for a four-hour shift on Sundays. We would bring our chair massage. So I don't know if you've ever seen the chair massage where kind of, you know, lay into the chair. And first and foremost with the patients. So we would do bedside massage. And, you know, it might have been just an arm, a shoulder, legs, feet. The feet are critical. But just to bring the human touch, to bring some relaxation, to allow that just release, that deep breath of letting go. And that would be, you know, the morning. And then once we had finished with the patients, we would do family. We would offer chair massage to the family members. Because think about the stress that they're going through, as you must have just gone through.
Was anything about massage off-putting to you? I mean, you're a woman. You're working on men. That kind of thing. Was there anything that had to be gotten over?
Oh, I mean, the school was great in terms of teaching, you know, professional ethics and boundaries and how to deal with all of that. I'm pretty clear in my own approach to things, how I manage myself. And as long as you set appropriate boundaries and, you know, you're bringing health to somebody. So there are very clear boundaries and your intentions and your approach to it. You know, I have been working part-time. I've not had any issues. So, you know, people that are coming in for massage are coming with that intention.
Are you a feminist?
Absolutely.
Can you define that for me and tell me how that strikes you?
Yeah, you know, I think as a word, sometimes it gets loaded, but as a way you bring yourself to the world, it just means we are all in this together, no better, no worse, no up, no down. I mean, I thank you and Glenn early on in terms of...
That's Glenn Doty, who was the editor.
Who was the editor of the Legislative Gazette. You know, the expectation was you're going to get down there and you're going to do your job, period. You know, just get it done. And I think a lot of what I've been able to do in terms of, you know, let's be honest, a lot of the anti-poverty work that I have done and continue to do, women suffer more through poverty-related issues in our country. Women and children carry the biggest burden of poverty and discrimination. Women of color, children of color, even more so. And I think it's our job to continually try to level that playing field and bring people up.
As a woman in a career, which has ended so beautifully, have you ever really been challenged on that level? You know, you're not a man, so you shouldn't be doing this.
Not so much you're not a man, you shouldn't be doing this, but early on, you know, it was clear, and still, I mean, let's be honest, you know, the old boys network, you know, you're figuring I came up in, you know, 1978, and I was 21, about to turn 21. You know, it was some of that was more age, some of it was sex, gender, and, you know, but breaking through some of those barriers. I think later in my career, more in the legal services realm, what I felt more was, you're not an attorney, so why are you here and why are you doing this? And, you know, not a lot, but I would get it once in a while, that undercurrent of, you don't know because you're not.
You've been around for a long time, Ann Erickson. Can I ask how old you are?
I will be 62 in April.
How is that possible?
Day by day.
How's that possible? Okay. So because you've been around a while, because you've taken a look at this country, because some things can get you angry, tell me about how you're reacting to Donald Trump.
Oh, my God. It's so disheartening. You know, it's just so disheartening. We've been through, particularly down in Albany in the legislature, and again, working on things like access to justice and anti-poverty work, you come up against it a lot. That attitudinal, you know, we don't need to worry about those things. I have never seen someone so disdainful and so full of contempt that it just is, I go from being angry to just being so, I don't know, just disheartened, heartbroken, that this is my country and this guy is representing us in a way that is just contemptuous. you know, whether it's his disdain for people with disabilities or his inciting people to throw him out and beat the guy up and he's a bum. And it's disgusting. I don't even know where to put the right words.
As a feminist, you have to be offended by, by the kind of stuff we're hearing.
But not even as a feminist. I just think as a human being, we should all be taken aback by the way he treats people and the way he talks about people. And again, just that contempt and disdain. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, we've had, Nixon and Bush and here in Albany, Pataki, who we had a lot of disagreements with, but never that sense of, I just keep going back to contempt and disdain. And that's the attitude of the President of the United States. I don't know that we ever get our reputation back after this. It's going to be a long haul.
You, Ann Erickson, know the legislature as well as anybody. You know who these people are, women and men, and you know that they fought for higher salaries. Now we're having a huge debate as to whether or not there ought to be public financing of elections. The Assembly, under Carl Hastie, was all for it, as long as the Republicans would say no. Now the Republicans are no longer there. The Democrats in the Senate and the Democrats in the Assembly are dragging their behinds as opposed to making it happen. In New York City, they have it. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we should have public financing of campaigns. It's not an issue that I've spent a lot of time with because, we don't do a lot of electoral campaign work or get involved in those issues. We have enough on our plates with the access to justice issues we deal with. But it's fascinating to watch this new legislature because it is a new legislature like we haven't seen in a long time.
How do you mean?
Well, not just the Democrats have taken the Senate, but a large margin. There are, 17 new senators? I mean, that's huge turnover. We never saw turnover like that. We have a sense of optimism and a sense that, yes, we can get these things done, whether it's some of the anti-discrimination work, access work, abortion rights work, those things are just really having their day in a way. And that's been exciting to see. To sit at the budget hearings and see someone like Senator Liz Krueger at the dais and Assemblywoman Helene Weinstein leading the most powerful positions in the state budget process.
Now, they used to be the backbenchers because they were in the minority.
Absolutely. And Helene, we honored Empire Justice. We honored Helene last year. It's the first time we've honored a legislator for all the work that she did as chair of judiciary those many years. And now to see her as chair of Ways and Means is just, it's just wonderful.
Okay. But I guess the question is, human nature being what it is, and I want to go back to what I was asking you about. You got there the old way. So if you put in a new way, which is public campaign financing, obviously you risk getting kicked out the way AOC kicked out Joe Crowley.
It does open the field, because it used to be the only people that could run were the incumbents or people that
politically
had personal wealth or could raise a lot of money. It's hugely expensive to run for office, which I think in and of itself is something we should be looking at. But the public financing would definitely give an opportunity to more different, diverse candidates.
Yeah. In order to lobby, you got to make friends with these people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also true about people on the radio who interview these folks. At what point do you have to put and keep some distance between you and them?
There is a collegiality that kind of runs through the system. And that's another thing that's a little disheartening these days is that it is so political, with a capital P. There used to be you would run and you would do your campaign and you would win or lose. And then you would come to Albany and you would leave the campaigns behind you and you would get to work on policy issues. Now it's constant campaigning. And I think there is more, not so much at the state level, but much more of a, you know, we can't agree because then they're going to use it against us, or then, you know, it'll be a campaign issue. But we do need to get things done. And compromise is not a bad word. I mean, that's sort of what we're built on. And what we do as advocates is try to find that point of agreement. And, you know, and a lot of what we do is message back and forth. You know, well, we meet with the Senate, and okay, they're willing to do this, this, and this. And then we go to the Assembly and say, okay, well, they're willing to do this, this, and this. And can we find some common ground? And that is a lot of what our job is trying to find that common ground so that we can get to a point of at least some movement forward. We'll come in with the ideal. You know, we want to make sure that we have universal access to health care. Oh, we want to make sure that there's, you know, access to justice. We would love to see a right to counsel in certain issues. New York City right now is experimenting, or not experimenting, they are rolling out a right to counsel in eviction proceedings, so that if you're being evicted, you have a right to an attorney. We'd love to see that rolled out to the rest of the state, where if somebody's going to be losing the roof over their head, that there be some due process and that there be an ability to be heard in court on that. We'd love to see a right to counsel on things like immigration issues. When you are going to be deported back to a country where you risk literally your life, there should be an attorney by your side. Doesn't mean you get to stay. It means you get to have a decent voice and a real ability to be heard.
Ann Erickson, I guess I wanted to talk to you about some of the changes. Now, you mentioned how a whole bunch of new Democratic legislators are in the state Senate, for example. And now you have the Assembly, which is, you know, going to be Democratic for a long time, unless I miss my guess. And yet, there may be some tension between them. Is that to be expected?
I think so. You know, I think so. I think it changes the dynamic. As you said, for many years, there were issues where one house could say, we're definitely for it, and knowing that the other house would never go anywhere near it. And so you had the cover of being for something that you knew was not really going to happen. And that's not so true anymore. I think the younger, newer members of the legislature will be pushing for change more aggressively and expect the system to be a little more responsive. So we'll see how that plays out.
Now, Andrew Cuomo has made it quite clear to me that the agenda of some of the people who got the Democrats into power, in other words, the new suburban Democrats, Westchester,
Long Island, are
going to be more conservative by nature than some of the people from the big city. And I think Cuomo, who I suspect is somewhat more conservative than liberal, is making that argument because he sees these people as a bulwark to help him control the excess spending in New York State, which has made it the number one tax state in the country. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of interested in your take on this. Is there potential for dissolution there, or do you think that this is all spurious?
So I think the change in Long Island has been fascinating, you know, and of course, that's where I grew up. Nine of my brothers and sisters still live on Long Island, so we're a force now.
But the Erickson family.
Yeah, right. But I think there is a little bit more of conservative nature for the new Long Island folks, because Long Island, it's the property taxes that are killing people.
Sure.
You know, there's, you know, $15,000, $20,000, $22,000 just a year in property taxes, which is unbelievable. So I think there will be some conservative nature there on fiscal issues. You know, on the social issues, I don't know. You know, we'll see how it shakes out. Yeah, we're doing a lot of work right now on the immigration access to justice around immigration issues and making sure that there is an ability to be heard. And the governor has done some investment there, you know, going back and forth with them on exactly where and how those investments are being made. But at least they're being made. So that's good.
Well, the immigration issue is fascinating to me. And I'm not surprised that you guys are playing a role in it. But it's got to be somewhat daunting to answer the question of why people should be let into the country without doing it legally.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, they come to the border and they're turning themselves in, which is a lot of what's going on, and they're seeking asylum and they are refugees. You know, the opportunity to be heard, I think, is bedrock to who we are as a country. You know, we've been at Empire Justice, we've been doing immigration work since 94, 95. I mean, we've been in this for a while. And of course, it's not a state level policy issue so much because the feds set, you know, the immigration laws. But in terms of how those laws are then interpreted, whether or not people have a right to be heard, whether or not there is due process. I mean, you saw what happened here in Albany with the Albany County jail situation. And the biggest thing that Sheriff Apple did was to say, I'm going to let these people have access to justice. He didn't say, I'm going to make decisions about whether or not they should be here. He said, I'm going to make sure that they have access to services. And I think that's critical.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to the remarkable Ann Erickson. Ann has been an extraordinary figure in Albany. So how do you leave? Why do you leave?
Yeah. So, you know, why I'm leaving, I think it has been such an honor to do this work, and it's been an extraordinary run. You know, when I came to what was then the Greater Upstate Law Project in 1989, you know, we were...
To me, that seems like yesterday, by the way.
I know. You know, we were, I don't know, 12 people in a $1.2 million operation, and I've been able to grow it, you know.
And what is it now?
Well, we branded and became the Empire Justice Center. We now have offices in Rochester, Albany, Westchester, Long Island. So I opened the Long Island office. I've expanded the Westchester office. We are now 65 advocates and about a $7 million budget. Mm. You know, so it's been awesome. We've been able to do things like creating, you know, and not alone, obviously with partners and colleagues, but we've created a network of services for families at risk of foreclosure. And we're hoping in this budget that the state picks that up and continues it through the Communities First program, which they're debating right now. We've done some expansion on the immigration work through the Liberty Defense Project with the Cuomo administration. We've been able to expand access to justice in a significant way. The Permanent Commission, of which I'm just one member, but, you know, being some of the voice here in Albany, we're now investing in civil legal services and way beyond any other state.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like time to just let the next generation of leaders come up, you know, and let them start bringing their vision, their policy advocacy, their litigation work. You know, we've done amazing class action litigation over the years where we've really been able to establish not just statutory rights, but case law. And it's, it's a good moment, I think.
So how do you get around the concept of, you know, a founder? You're basically a founder because, well, it was here before, but look at what you just said has been done.
I've taken it to the next step, and now it's for someone else to take it to yet the next step.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are your fears, Ann?
My fears? Personally or professionally? Yeah. Well, my fear, it's not really fear, it's a little bit of trepidation. I wouldn't say fear, but, you know, that I will get lost or that I won't know what to do next. But I enjoy traveling. I think, you know, being a licensed massage therapist will come into play in a new way where I can be doing, you know, I've been doing a lot of really big stuff, you know, big picture stuff, big state work, big policy work. And now I can get a little bit more down to a more personal level in terms of stress release and helping people that way, a little more one-on-one rather than huge picture issues. I am really looking forward to a few moments of just decompressing and not really doing a whole lot. Like, I stressed myself about, what are you going to do next? And now you got to do this, and now you could do that. And I'm trying to hold back and just say, you know what? Until you create the void, you don't know what is going to enter. And so I have to really just let that space open and see what comes in.
You're going to stay in Albany, or you're going to go back to Long Island from whence you came?
I am staying in Albany for a while. You know, that was another thing. It was like, oh my God, I got to retire. I got to sell the house. I got to move. And I'm like, no. You can just take it one step at a time. So I'm going to retire, let that space open. I'm going to stay in Albany for a while. I'm going to dig in my garden. I'm going to get my hands dirty. I'm going to, you know, have fun and travel. I'm looking forward to traveling with my sisters, and we have a bunch of us that are going to Florida. We're going to spend a week together. Like, love to go out to Colorado, visit my brothers and nieces and nephews out there, and Arizona. My nephew just had a baby. I'd love to get out there. So, you know, maybe even just get in the car and drive across the country. I don't know.
Do you have enough money?
Is there ever enough, Alan? It's a leap of faith. You know, one of the things being in the not-for-profit world. You know, there were moments where I had opportunities to go into state work and didn't, and now I kind of like, oh, no pension, no retiree benefits. I would love, one of the things I am working on, I would love to see the state take a closer look at the nonprofit community and see if it could help us a little bit more. Well, you know, we had talked a number of years ago with the state about whether or not there was ability to either open the state pension system that the not-for-profit community could buy into, open the state health benefit system that, and allow the not-for-profit community to buy into that and be able to leverage the purchasing power of the state. That would help us tremendously. We at Empire Justice, we're so committed to access to justice, you know, whether it's for our clients or our staff. That's a huge expense, and that would be great to see something like that happen. But for me personally, do I have enough money? I don't know, but I think so, and I think I'm going to just take that leap of faith. The healthcare is going to be a big issue. I'm going to have to figure that one out.
We've been talking for the last hour with one of my favorite people in the whole world, and I do mean that, and somebody I honor with no reservation at all, the great Ann Erickson, who has done an incredible amount of work in her already, and I can say this, young life. So, Anne, if you had it to do over again, and we got 1 minute here, anything you'd like to change?
I don't think so. I have loved being part of the legal services community. As I said, when I first came in, I really didn't understand the importance of access to justice and the importance of making sure that people had attorneys to represent them and speak for them and raise their voice. That has been amazing. And I just have loved what I've been able to do.
Ann Erickson, somebody I've known most of my adult life and had nothing but praise for, who was able to take up the cudgels of power, not take any crap from anybody, and do what was needed.
And I have to just say thank you to you, Alan, because you shaped my early career in ways that have resonated throughout my whole life. I mean, by giving me opportunities, standing behind me when I said things like, yeah, we're going to do a fundraiser, you know, just always having my back, and I appreciated that so much.
Which is why you have to stay as the vice chair of the WAMC board until I tell you you can go, which is never.
I'm committed.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.